Pleasure to be here today. I come from the Kinsey Institute for the Study of Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. What I'm going to talk to you about today is the neural systems that might be related to human partnering. And my specific research investigates how hormones might influence these neural systems to bias a person towards or away from a risky sexual decision or sexual partner. So sex carries the potential for both risks and rewards. You can have an STD or an STI, as you guys study, or there's also the potential for the reward of a pleasurable social interaction and intimacy. So the decision to engage in a sexual encounter, and specifically who to engage in that sexual interaction with, involves the cost and benefit analysis of the potential risks and rewards of that encounter. So we think that hormones influence the cognitive processes of attention, reward-seeking, risk-taking in the brain to alter how a woman might perceive potential risks and rewards of a sexual encounter. And although I study individual variation in hormones and how this affects individual variation in the brain, I think the point maybe of this me being included in this symposium is to suggest to you guys there might be some higher level population differences in hormonal profiles that could be relevant to some more high risk subgroups with different hormone profiles. So we do know a lot about hormones and behavior, although we don't know as much about hormones in the brain. What we know about hormones and behavior in women is that mid-cycle, when a woman's closer to ovulation and more fertile, there's an increase in sexual desire, masturbation, and sexual initiation. So generally more sexual seeking and sexual behavior going on mid-cycle. In addition to simply being more directed towards sex at this time of the cycle, we also know from behavioral studies that women have different preferences for who they'll engage in sex with across their menstrual cycle. So of recent interest in the literature has been this idea of masculinity, so testosterone-related traits in men. This could be bone growth, pheromones, odor, voice, some personality traits like dominance or sort of charisma. These masculine traits or testosterone-related traits have been of interest to recent researchers, and they found that women's interest in masculine traits vary across the menstrual cycle. Specifically, there's an increased preference behaviorally that women report for more masculine men mid-cycle when they're closer to ovulation, also when they're experiencing increased sex drive and desire, et cetera. And these preferences for masculine men are actually directly correlated with hormone levels, suggesting possibly a causal effect of the hormones. And I think also interestingly, and implicating of the role of hormones more directly, is that women who use hormonal contraceptives actually don't show the same partner preferences that women do who are not on hormonal contraceptives. So women on hormonal contraceptives actually subjectively report interest in more feminine men or men with less testosterone-related traits. Now this is relevant not just because it's interesting in our dating world, but because the preference for a masculine man might come with costs. Men who have higher testosterone, again in sort of correlational behavioral studies, have been shown to maybe not be the most stable partners for a woman. They don't partner as often in stable partnerships, and when they do, they have higher likelihoods of divorce and infidelity, and perhaps aren't as responsive to their offspring. So why would a woman even go near a masculine guy if he's got all these risks? Well, the masculine man also has some rewards. Again, with some of the personality characteristics, the masculine phenotype is thought to be a little more charismatic and interesting, but from a more basic level, masculinity is thought to be an indicator of genetic fitness. The idea from an evolutionary perspective is that women seek partners who can give them good genetics for their offspring. And you want your offspring to have good immune function, and that would be an indicator of genetic fitness. Well, testosterone in some animal studies has been shown to be immunosuppressive. So the very sort of speculative idea here that I won't entirely stand behind, but I'll just give you the background, is that testosterone, if it's immune suppressive, then men who exhibit high testosterone-related traits are thought to be more genetically fit. So women could used masculine traits, or such as a jaw structure or a voice, as a proxy for how genetically fit that man might be. So together, the literature talks about the masculine partner and women's decision making and this idea of changing reproductive priorities or contexts. So ideally, a woman can find a potential partner or mate who would give both genetic quality to her potential child and also be a good partner or father to her. But unfortunately, in the real world, it doesn't always act that way. And if the two are out of sync in a partner, then maybe she has to alter, you know, her priorities of risk and reward and what's most important to her. And we argue that hormones and the reproductive state in which a woman finds herself in might be important to how she's evaluating those risks and reward and her priorities. So we've got this behavior literature showing some influence of hormones on behavior, but what's not known is how are hormones doing this, if they're doing it at all? What's the proximate mechanism by which hormones are actually influencing women's behavior and their partner preferences? Well, we would think a likely starting point is in the brain. So there's been some literature, not with partners so much, but with general reward seeking and other rewarding stimuli across a woman's menstrual cycle in the brain. And it's been shown recently that close to ovulation, a woman's reward system is sort of more sensitive and more active in response to things like money or erotic videos, and that this system, this reward system, actually is more active in postmenopausal women if you give them exogenous hormones. So it's possible, simply, that men are more rewarding mid-cycle. But it's probably not that simple. There's probably some other things going on, too. What about the perception of men? So nothing can't be rewarding if you can't cue into what the characteristics are of that potential reward. There's also nice behavioral literature out there showing that women's ability to actually detect certain facial cues or other indicators of fitness or not fitness from a man actually change across her cycle. So it's possible that these masculine facial features, for example, simply aren't really processed in the brain as much during certain phases of the menstrual cycle. So our study simply asks the question, does neural activation change across the menstrual cycle in response to potential sexual partners? And we hypothesized that we would see differences at different points of the menstrual cycle in how women's brains respond to potential sexual partners, specifically in brain regions related to reward processing that should be more sensitive mid-cycle, and also in regions of the brain related to sensory processing. I know this N looks small to you guys from your field, but 12 women in an fMRI study is pretty standard. So we had 12 women come into our fMRI study. And for those of you guys who aren't familiar with functional magnetic imaging, basically they lie in a tube, they stay really still, they look at pictures from a computer screen, and we measure the blood flow change in their brain as an indirect proxy of the neural activation. So the women who came into our study were aged 23 through 28. They're heterosexual and not currently in a relationship. And we had them come in right about just before ovulation, days 10 through 12, and later in the cycle. And all women were tested for testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone at each session and completed some questionnaires about their real-world sexual behavior. So what they did while they were in the fMRI was look at pictures of men. And the men were black and white photos that had been masculinized or feminized. And how we masculinize or feminize a face is with a program called Psychomorph. People do it differently, but this is one of the most objective ways, I think. There's a program made by a group in Scotland, and basically you give it a composite of an average man and a composite of an average woman, and it makes your the face that you put into the program look more like that man or more like that woman based on the facial structure. So it does some spatial algorithms to alter your original face to be more like the man or more like the woman. And if you look at the computer doing it, what it seems to do actually is lengthen the jaw and collapse the brow ridge a bit. But this is an example of what the difference would be. It's really subtle. So if anyone's ovulating in the audience, they could probably tell us which one's masculine. I think the man on the right is the masculinized version. The man on the left is the feminized, but I'm not entirely sure. Opposite?
Okay, nice.
So you can see it's very subtle. And some of you in the audience are probably saying, I can't tell a difference. And some of you, it's probably very obvious. Thanks. So this was our implicit indicator of risk. The masculine face would be the more risky choice, potentially more rewarding, and the feminine face would be the less risky choice. In addition to the implicit indicator of risk, we also wanted to give the women an explicit indicator of how sexually risky this man might be. So each face was accompanied by his previous number of sexual partners and his typical condom use. So this would be an example of what the woman actually saw on the scanner. She just saw a single face, and then how many previous sexual partners he'd had, and the man's sexual typical condom use. We presented 56 originals that had been morphed to be masculine or feminine, so this, and then each of the morphed masculine or feminine phenotypes was also presented as a high and low risk man. So all the comparisons across categories of pictures are actually the same men, which makes it a little more valid, I think. Now, we also needed a control stimulus set, because any changes we observed across the menstrual cycle, we wanted to know whether it was specific to sexual decision making or whether it was just a more generalized phenomenon about decision making. So we included pictures of houses, and the women had to evaluate how likely they would be to rent the houses. So this gives the rental cost and the typical landlord maintenance. So this would be an example. Women were presented blocks of... It's fun presenting to a new audience who thinks it's funny. So women were presented blocks of 5 minutes in which each picture of different types was shown for 4 seconds each, and they were presented for 8 blocks total. So now we're gonna get to the results. This first result is how women's brains responded to the low risk. That's the explicit information about the sexual partners and condom use compared to high risk. So just to orient you to the results I'm gonna be showing, that's the brain. And the areas of blue right here are parts of the brain that responded more to low risk partners. So there's a few points I wanna make here. One is the regions of the brain we saw active during the sexual decision-making task included the anterior cingulate and some region of the brainstem. And this circuit is really similar, in fact, pretty much overlaps with the system we see active during economic decision-making, which I think makes a good argument for the fact that sexual decision-making isn't all that special in the brain or cognitively. It's another form of decision-making, and I think that thought influences how we can study it. But that's a tangent. In response to low-risk men, women had increased activation in some reward systems of the brain and areas of the brain related to attraction and arousal, which is good. Women were more interested in low-risk men in the brain. There were no areas in the brain that were more responsive to explicitly high-risk sexual partners. And for those of you in the audience who actually work with people in the real world, just to give you some relevance, I did some new analyses for this talk and found, surprisingly enough to me, that women's neuroactivation in our lab was related to the real-world sexual behavior they report. So what you see on these graphs, the area, the direction with the red arrow indicates higher risk, the direction the arrow is pointing. So in the x-axis is on the left is how many partners the woman has had in her lifetime. On the right, it's how often she used condoms. So a higher number of sexual partners would be higher risk. On the graph on the right, it goes from never using condoms to always using condoms. So what you see here is that areas of activation in the lab in response to lower risk stimuli were correlated positively with their self-reports of lower risk sexual behavior in the real world. And this is just some pilot data, but I think it does give a little more credence to what we're doing in the lab. So that was their brain in response to low risk, explicitly given information, which is great that they respond more to low risk men. But what about the real world. Men don't walk around with t-shirts giving their sexual partners and condom use, but women have to infer the sexual risk of this potential partner based on cues possibly like masculinity. So this first slide just shows you that their brains did in fact respond differently to the masculinized versus feminized faces, which I was actually very surprised about given just how similar those faces look to me. And interestingly, what you see here is increased activation in brain regions related to face processing and sensory processing and attention in response to the masculinized faces. So as I told you, one of the hypotheses was that there's differences in sensory processing across the cycle. So what we see here is that there's differences in sensory processing regions in response to masculinized faces, supporting the idea that the sensory processing system could be important in terms of biasing women towards certain kinds of sexual partners. So this is just overall, and also in terms of giving you some real world validity. Women's neuroactivation, both of these graphs show total number of sexual partners. So, I'm sorry, both of these graphs show condom use. So a lower value would be riskier behavior. So what you see here on the left is increased insula activation, and the insula is a brain region that's often seen active in response to negative things or disgusting things or risky things. And what you see here is that lower insula activation or lower detection of negatively arousing things was associated with riskier sexual behavior. So, and then you also see another region of the brain related to attention was also negatively associated with condom use. So again, these data are pilot, and I'm just sort of here to be provocative, but it's possible that women who don't perceive the masculine men quite as much in the brain aren't getting the cues they need to make good decisions, and perhaps are making worse decisions. But what about hormones? So we did find some correlations in the regions of the brain. Specifically, progesterone was negatively correlated with activation in these brain regions. In progesterone, what you see a little chart on the left is the menstrual cycle, and red is estrogen, blue is progesterone. Progesterone increases at the end of the cycle when women report less interest in masculine men. So this negative correlation in these brain regions in relation to their neural response to masculine men furthers our suggestion that women's brains respond differently to masculine men across the menstrual cycle. And when we actually look at that statistically, we see that's the case, that when you look within the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle in women, they have a stronger response to masculine men in all of these sensory processing regions. In addition, they also have increased activation in the anterior cingulate cortex in response to masculine men only close to ovulation. The anterior cingulate cortex is important. It's been implicated in economic decision-making and other decision-making to be correlated with risky decision-making, but highly rewarding endpoints. So mid-cycle, women really do seem to be, their brains really seem to be computing this idea of a risky versus a rewarding choice. And the anterior cingulate activation was positively correlated with testosterone, which is a hormone that's important for risk-taking and sexual motivation. And then I think this is my favorite data, and I think maybe the most relevant. So what is driving women then to go out, if they're perceiving that masculine men maybe are a little more risky during mid-cycle, what's altering that scale to be a little more reward-seeking? And what this data shows is how women's brains are responding to men overall. So what this shows is that there's an increase in activation response to those men overall in a region called the orbital frontal cortex. So the orbital frontal cortex is a region that has been shown to be more active mid-cycle in response to drugs, money, erotic stimuli, other things that people like, suggesting there's an increased general reward sensitivity in the brain in response to not just all these other repetitive things that we see in literature, but also in response to men. So women simply might be more reward-seeking mid-cycle and more willing to take that risk with the masculine man. What you see here in the graph is the difference in activation in this region, the orbital frontal cortex, during the follicular phase minus the activation in the luteal phase. So you get a degree of difference. What you see here is that we not only saw differences in activation in this region in response to faces, but also surprisingly in response to houses. So the women did like the houses, And although the change in reward sensitivity wasn't as strong for houses as it was for faces, there does seem to be a sort of generalized increase in reward-seeking mid-cycle. And activation in this region was also positively correlated with the estrogen to progesterone ratio. And again, I'm showing you here the menstrual cycle. And what you see, it's this ratio of estrogen in red to progesterone that really gives you a feel for where a person is in their cycle. So this positive relationship between activation in this region and the estrogen to progesterone ratio further implicates hormones. And I think this difference in responsivity of the brain across the two cycles might be the most relevant thing in terms of real-world behavior. So what you see here is, again, difference in orbital frontal activation on the y-axis. And on the right is how many partners, sexual partners, a woman has had in a lifetime. And this difference in activation, so the change in activation across the cycle, is a nice predictor of her real-world high-risk behavior. And so if something's going wrong, you think about how can we fix it, probably. Hormonal contraceptives, women don't ovulate if they're using them. So they don't show the same fluctuation in hormones that women do who are not using them. So you would think that women using hormonal contraceptives might not show this difference in not only hormones across the cycle, but also in their response to men, especially in the frontal cortex. So we have a small group of women, only about half. It's just, again, pilot data to sort of be provocative. But we found that women using oral contraceptives did not show as strong of a difference in orbital frontal activation response to men as women did who were not on oral contraceptives, although they did show a difference. And I think it's because the women in the study were using triphasics, and I don't have hormone measures on them, but they probably did have some differences in hormones. But for women using oral contraceptives, just like we saw for the women who were not, we saw a positive relationship between their activation, the difference in activation across two time points in this region and their number of sexual partners. So together, I just want to leave you with the fact that the brain does respond differently based on the characteristics of a potential sexual partner. And how the brain responds might be related to their real-world behavior, and lab studies might be relevant to what women are doing in the real world. I think there's some preliminary data to kind of speculate that hormones alter neural activation to increase reward bias and possibly risk-taking mid-cycle. Although all this data I showed you was pretty much correlational, and there's absolutely no idea at this point the direction of causation, so I won't even pretend to say there is. But in conclusion, as practitioners, I'd like you guys to think about the fact that hormones set the stage in which a woman is processing potential sexual partners and her context. So if women, if certain subgroups of women have different hormone profiles, that might put them at risk to perceive in their world differently and possibly engaging in different levels of risk-taking behavior. So I think this study that I presented really possibly raises more questions than it answers. I think it's just a nice starting point for beginning to think about how hormones might have a role in STD prevention and intervention. I think it's really important we transfer data from the lab to other outside to the real world. And I think one way we can do this is looking at different populations. Currently, Dennis and I are looking at adolescent women with this paradigm to see if their special hormonal status and brain status in which their reward system is more sensitive might further increase their bias towards risky partners. And we're also looking at alcohol-dependent women who also have a reward sensitivity that might alter their bias towards risky partners. But I think this is just a starting point suggesting that many other groups of women could be, this could be an important variable in their behavior. I'd like to thank my funding and my collaborators and you for your attention.
We have time for one or two questions that just to clarify methodology. We would like to sort of save questions and discussion over the whole thing for the end. But if you have a question that Heather could answer that would help you understand what she just said, besides having a PhD as well, please ask now. You'll have to speak loudly.
Okay. It was a great presentation, and I understood what the question is. My question is, and actually, I'm really glad that you're looking at adolescent women.
Basically, the question was the importance of early menarche and how that might influence both long-term and acute brain development and risk-taking. Is that accurate? Which is exactly the R01 that Dennis and I are writing right now. So this is where I think the importance of hormonal profiles for a developing brain, when those hormones hit that brain, is going to be really important. So I think it adds a lot of credence to understanding why there's some shifts in certain populations in time of menarche. And we don't know the implications yet, but I think it's possible there are some that should be studied. So we don't know, and we're going to study it.
We will do some more discussion after Peter's spoken. Thank you, Heather.